This week, the precious metals entered positive territory, while the Dow Jones Industrials moved higher for the 8th week in a row, ending at yet another record. Well, happy Thanksgiving and welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzak, here with you. We have a big show in store for you this holiday weekend. Equities investors certainly have much to be thankful for this year. Stocks finished yet another week on an up note, with the NASDAQ ending over 4,000 for the first time since those frothy dot-com days almost 13 years ago. Harry S. Dent Jr. is less sanguine on the sector. He says investors should consider hedging their profits with two particular investments, so you'll want to be sure and listen to the discussion for the ticker symbols. He's also expecting the precious metals to rebound. Then Peter Schiff and I discuss various economic indicators, focusing in on the new year, 2014, and the new Fed chair. Plus, Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest editorial. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week as investors shunned the declining U.S. dollar in favor of the metals, as well as insatiable demand from China for the precious metals. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added about $10, finishing the week at $12.52 an ounce. Silver picked up about 10 cents, finishing near $20 an ounce. Top story driving the metals this week, reports of massive demand from China. Trading volume on the Shanghai Gold Exchange topped 18 tons. That's the best showing in nearly 2 months. Plus, net gold imports from Hong Kong reached a new record of over 100 tons. Elsewhere, rumor on the street indicates that Venezuela is considering a swap deal for its gold with investment bank Goldman Sachs, but the idea was actually declined by officials. The idea was to infuse the cash-poor nation with $1.68 billion in lieu of Venezuela's gold reserves, not quite 50 tons of the metal in stockpiles there. It amounts to three-quarters, though, of the nation's reserve currency, according to Bloomberg News. Venezuela's gold reserves total about 370 tons, making it the 14th largest holding by country, according to the World Gold Council. But the total price tag for the swap/loan was staggering over a 7-year period. According to some sources, the nation is entering severe stagflationary conditions, approaching even hyperinflationary levels of more than 50% amid huge currency debasement and a runaway stock market. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, clearly the U.S. dollar weakness and solid demand from China helped put a floor under the precious metals this week. Plus, seasonal factors are also coming into play. Please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter on Monday for all the stock picks and next week's report. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited. For the 8th consecutive week, the Dow Jones Industrials recorded a higher close and a new all-time record high. By Friday's closing bell on the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrials added over 20 points, finishing at 16,086. The S&P 500 picked up just 1 point, though, ending at 1805, while the NASDAQ outperformed its peers, picking up 68 points for the week, breaking out to a new high, not quite 2%, and finishing for the first time over 4,000 since the dot-com mania days at 4059. The S&P 500 also closed at an all-time high of 1807, up nearly 30% for the year, in what is set to be the best annual rally in 15 years. Apple Computer climbed about 2%. A report showed the company sold 3 of every 4 smartphones in Japan last month. The Philadelphia Housing Index also rallied, ending the week at the highest point in nearly 6 months. The index is an excellent proxy for the overall housing market. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, according to the 7-component fear sentiment index that we watch, greed remains elevated, but it's still not at frothy levels. So be sure to log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account over the weekend or on Monday for the rest of the report and the stock picks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com Radio with Harry S. Dent Jr. and Peter Schiff. So we want you to stay with us here at GoldSeek.com. Well, Peter Schiff is President and Chief Global Strategist of Euro-Pacific and the author of several bestsellers. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Welcome, Peter Schiff.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Let's begin with the latest gold forecast from Goldman Sachs. You say that Goldman analysts might be off base here. Could you tell us how come?
Well, I don't think Goldman necessarily understands what's going on with the U.S. economy. Although, in many cases, you know, you have to take what Goldman says with a grain of salt, because oftentimes what they say publicly is the opposite of what they do privately. You know, they try to move the market in the opposite direction, because if they want to buy, you know, they want low prices, they need to convince people to sell. So that's the skeptic in me, you know, always looks at what they say from that perspective. But assuming that they're buying into the same false paradigm as everybody else, you've got this this perception out there that the U.S. economy is experiencing a genuine recovery, that the rest of the world is still having problems because they didn't follow the right prescription. We did stimulus. They were making the mistake of austerity. And so we're going to keep growing. The rest of the world is going to have problems. The Fed is going to be able to tighten now or take away the QE. Other central banks are going to have to do more QE to follow our example because they're behind. And so the idea is we have the strongest economy. The recovery is going to continue. The Fed's going to tighten. The worst is over. The Armageddon scenario didn't come out. There's nothing to worry about. Therefore, there's absolutely no reason to buy gold. Plus, there's no inflation. So there's no economic problems. There's no inflation. Everything is great. So gold's going to crash. That's what everybody believes. Of course, everybody is completely wrong. The U.S. economy is not recovering. All we have is a stimulus-induced high. And because it's all stimulus-related, the Fed can't taper like everybody expects. I think the Fed is going to increase QE, and it's going to be increasing it. The U.S. economy is going to be slipping back into recession. That's one of the reasons for the increase. And, of course, more QE means the economy can't recover because QE is actually inhibiting the recovery. So I think the rest of the world is actually in better shape than the U.S., and I don't believe that inflation is not a problem. I think it's a serious problem. We just don't acknowledge it. It's going to get a lot worse, especially given the announcement by China just last week that they have finally publicly admitted that it is not in their interest to expand their reserves any further, and they are willing to let their currency appreciate. Those two go hand in hand. But what that means is that the dollar will go down and that our biggest external buyer of bonds, U.S. Treasuries, is not going to be there anymore. And if the Bank of China is not going to be buying, and in the last quarter, the Bank of China bought about $55 billion per month in foreign exchange. Most of that was dollars. So they did at least $30 billion a month of QE for the U.S. all by itself. And so if China is not going to be buying all those bonds, and, of course, if China's not going to buy, a lot of other Asian economies are going to follow China's lead, and they're not going to buy. So the market around the world for U.S. Treasuries is drying up. So I think the Fed is going to pick up the pace of its own QE to try to, pick up the slack. Because if they don't do that, interest rates are headed a lot higher, which is what the Fed wants to prevent. Because when interest rates go up, it pricks the bubble that they've inflated.
Look at the numbers. Roughly two out of every three treasuries is being purchased at last check by the Fed already. If they suddenly curtail or lose their appetite, that is the world central bankers, for our paper, for our bonds, there's no buyer of last resort other than the Fed. And of course, as you said, interest rates starts to ratchet up. And then we've got that tedious little problem of $250 trillion in notional derivatives.
The whole economy is a pyramid based on debt. And, you know, when I hear people, they try to make excuses or say, well, you know, if interest rates go up, well, it's okay because it's, you know, the economy is done well with higher rates before. Even with the mortgage market, I hear people say, look, I remember when I bought a house and, you know, I had a 10% mortgage. So even if mortgage rates go to 6%, you know, it's still historically low. So it's not going to be a problem. Those people just do not understand at all the leverage in the U.S. economy and the degree to which we are dependent on cheap money. People can't afford 10% mortgages anymore because the real estate prices are much too high. The only reason people can afford even today's prices is because rates are so low. In fact, they're not even low enough anymore for people to afford it. Almost all the houses being bought are being bought for cash. by speculators who are buying, not actual homeowners. They're renting. That's why if you look at the numbers that came out yesterday on building permits, all the increase was in multifamily, which is the same thing as last month. So people aren't buying homes. They can't afford them, even at the mortgage rates they have now. And so rates go up, it crashes the market. We have so much debt right now, we can't afford to pay a normal amount of interest on that because we have an abnormal amount of debt. The only way that it works is if the rate is as low as it is right now. And if the rate goes up, then the economy buckles under the weight of the interest payments because we can't afford it. And if we're paying interest on our debt, then we don't have money to spend on other things. We can't keep going to the mall and shopping if all of our money is going to pay interest on the debt.
According to your latest article, the government is understating inflation via the CPI, which then artificially improves the real gross domestic product. It makes logical sense. You take a look at the shadow stats numbers we've been watching for years, and according to his chart, for almost 13 consecutive years, the U.S. has remained in a recession for nearly 13 years, and I'd like your thoughts.
Well, that makes a lot more sense to me than the fact that we've had all this economic growth, because the anecdotal evidence looks like the economy is in recession. If you look at the declining real incomes, if you look at the collapse in the labor force, if you look at the declining energy uses, if you look at all of the anecdotal evidence, you look at the number of people on food stamps, the number of people on disability, none of this is consistent with a growing economy. It's all consistent with recession. And in fact, when I go on a lot of these television shows and I question the validity of the CPI, one of the things that everybody always says is, well, if you're right, then the U.S. economy isn't even growing. It's in recession. Therefore, you can't be right because we know the economy is not in recession. And I'll say, well, how do you know that? Because the government tells you. To me, it feels like a recession. In fact, if you take polls of the public and ask them, they think it's a recession. They don't think there's a recovery. And in fact, when you ask the people in polls, what is your biggest economic problem? The number one response is always inflation, rising prices. So, the government says there's no inflation, yet that's the greatest concern that the average American has, is the increase in the cost of living. And most Americans think there's a recession. The people who don't think there's a recession are on Wall Street, because to them it's not a recession. It's a boom there, right? I mean, look at yesterday. Tiffany's came out with great earnings. They're increasing their prices. But meanwhile, Walmart, Kmart, Target all came out with bad numbers. And, Walmart said it's going to be the worst Christmas since 2009. I mean, they're already slashing prices already because they can't sell merchandise because their customers are broke.
No, exactly. And, we actually crunched the numbers here at GoldSeek.com radio on inflation in the footsteps of, once again, John Williams at ShadowStats.com. And one thing you note very quickly as you start to compile the composite features in our domestic CPI, you noted that the people out there are feeling the pinch of inflation, but that it's not really reflected in the PPI and the CPI and the CPI numbers, because you'll hear people cite, well, it's energy costs. Actually, energy is a very small component of the CPI. One of the more important components is housing.
Yeah, it's owner's equivalent rent. Well, here's what I understand, though, about the rents. Owner's equivalent rent is over like 40% of the CPI. And according to the government, it's barely going up. Rents are, going up, 1% or something like that. But all the articles I read about rents nationwide is that they're surging. And we know that home prices are rising. I mean, prices just had the biggest year-over-year increase since 2006. We got those numbers yesterday from Case Shiller. So if we have surging home prices and surging rents, how is the owner's equivalent rent not going up at all? I mean, what formula? Because it's not capturing the increase in home prices and it's not capturing the increase in rents. How is it supposed to be representative of what Americans are spending on housing? Plus, I know that people's utility bills are going up. I know that insurance rates are going up. Property taxes are going up. So the cost of home ownership is rising rather rapidly. The cost of renting is going up, yet the government claims that it's not going up at all.
You say the Fed's exporting our inflation.
Well, yeah, we export a lot of our inflation. I mean, some of it we hide with the statistics. But remember, what you know, the reason that inflation makes prices go up, right? And inflation is creating money, expanding the supply. That's literally what the word means. But the reason that when you create inflation, when you print money, prices go up is because you have more money chasing a the supply of goods that the economy is producing. So money is, you know, we all bid up prices. Money is the way you divide up, what's out there, what's been produced. So the more money you have, the higher prices have to be to clear the market. Now, what happens in America is we print all this money, but then instead of spending it on goods that are here in America, we ship it over to China. And now China ships us goods in exchange. So we're able to buy goods in China with that money. So it's not making prices go up in America because it's not chasing goods in America. We're sending the money to China. China's sending us goods. And so we get more goods. So prices don't go up here. They go up in China because now China's got extra money. They don't have as much goods because they ship their goods to us. And so now prices go up in China when the Chinese spend the money we send them in their own country. But, of course, the way they have to do that is they sell the dollars to the Bank of China. The Bank of China prints up RMB and gives it to the Chinese companies that sold products to America. They pay their workers. The workers take the money. They go to the store. But there's not as much stuff to buy because they've shipped all their stuff to America. So they have more money chasing fewer goods. They have the inflation problem over there. We don't have it over here, so we sent our inflation to China. But you know what China has now said is they're done importing it. They don't want it anymore. They're going to let their currency go up. They're not going to keep doing this. That means we're going to have to eat our own inflation. That means we're going to print money, and it's going to stay here. And prices are going up. And meanwhile, the goods, more of the goods will stay in China, so the prices will come down over there.
You also note that foreign central banks are actively preparing for an end for the dollar's global hegemony, citing European banks as well as China, as you just mentioned, the largest holder of U.S. debt. You talked about at some point we have to eat our own inflation. Could that happen overnight?
Yeah, it could happen overnight, but it's not going to be constrained to one single day. But certainly where there can be a day where it's a huge move down on the dollar. But when is that going to happen? I don't know exactly, but I got to think that it's coming soon. I mean, the question is, when does China implement the reforms that it just committed to? That's the thing. I think China really holds the key, because when China stops buying, or think about this, given the fact that China said that expanding their balance sheet is no longer in China's interest, it's also possible that they understand that their balance sheet is already too big, and that shrinking that balance sheet would be in China's interest. And I think China is perfectly positioned to shrink their balance sheet, because what I think China was doing, the whole time we've been doing Operation Twist, the Fed has been selling its short-term treasuries and buying long-term treasuries. I think the Chinese were taking the other side of the trade. I think they were selling their long-term treasuries and buying our short-term treasuries. And now they're perfectly positioned because they can just let those bonds mature. They don't have to sell anything. They don't have to worry about crashing the market. They just let the bonds mature, and their balance sheet contracts. And if they're going to do that, well, where are we going to get the money to repay the Chinese? Well, the only way we're going to get it is if the Fed creates out of thin air, which means QE is going to have to go way up. I mean, they're going to have to do well over $100 billion a month of QE. And the markets, are not prepared for that. The markets are trying to prepare for QE going away, the Fed shrinking its balance sheet. When the market realizes that the Fed is never going to taper, that this is a permanent policy that we have in America of QE and 0% interest rates, that it can never stop, right? Because it's like they keep saying, well, we're going to stop QE when the economy doesn't need it anymore, right? That's what they keep saying. Well, when people realize that the economy will always need it, it's like a drug addict saying, well, I'm going to stop taking drugs when I don't need them anymore. I'm going to stop taking drugs when I can stay high without the drugs. Well, you can't, right? So when people realize that, and that QE is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, that's the wake-up moment, and that's when the dollar just completely tanks and gold prices skyrocket. And, then the Fed is going to have to do something about the collapsing dollar. And the only thing it can do is raise interest rates sharply, sell treasuries, and then we have a massive financial crisis, much, much worse than what happened in 2008. And if the Fed doesn't do that because it doesn't want to precipitate a financial crisis worse than 2008, then we have something worse than that, because then they destroy the currency, we have runaway or hyperinflation, and that's going to be even worse than the crisis that they would create by trying to prevent that from happening.
If I understand your scenario correctly here, forget taper. It's all Fed rhetoric at this point. You're looking for beyond $1.2 trillion in Fed balance sheet expansion per year. I mean, we could be looking at more than $100 billion per month. You want to talk about money managers and professional investors essentially having to recalculate their expectations and portfolios. I mean, you're going to see a mass exodus away from this current environment and a flood into precious metals under that scenario. What signs should we be watching for?
You just got to watch the markets themselves, you know, watch the bond market, watch, I think the foreign exchange market is more important, looking at the dollar versus various currencies. The only currency that's really looking really strong right now, interestingly enough, is the British pound, which, you know, seems to be breaking out against the dollar and other currencies as well. So, but, you know, the euro is trying to turn. You know, the commodity currencies, though, are still in their downtrends, like the Aussie and the Canadian dollar. But, you know, once all these currencies really start to turn around and start to rise against the dollar, even the yen, you know, the yen has been weakening. But, you know, I would look at these foreign exchange markets. The bond market, the Fed can control for now because they can keep printing money to buy bonds to keep the yield on the 10-year below 3%. That's really their goal. But they have to keep buying a lot of bonds to do that, which means they have to print a lot of money. So I think you'll see the damage in the foreign exchange market before you really see a collapse in the bond market. And then look for a turn in the gold price. I mean, I don't know, you know, if they can't force the gold price lower and it really starts to go up, then maybe that's a sign that people are starting to figure it out.
Very good. Well, I wanted to move on to the equities markets. You know, the Dow Jones Industrials closed over 16,000 point, first time in its history, the highest level in its 117-year track record. How much of the impressive rally do you view as a result of the Fed's $1 trillion annual buying spree of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities?
Well, that is what is behind the rally. I mean, if the Fed wasn't doing that, the Dow would be considerably lower than it is today. So the reason the Dow is rising is because of the Fed. It's not because of a good economy. It's not because good earnings. It's because of bad monetary policy. That is what's driving it. And that's the only thing that's driving it. And so when the Fed eventually does the right thing, or if it does the right thing, the stock market's going a lot lower. If the Fed doesn't do the right thing, then it really doesn't matter how high the stock market goes, because it's just a nominal price. And I think that commodity prices will go up a lot higher than the stock market when people figure this out. And just the overall cost of living is going to go up a lot higher. You know, it's not really going to matter, right, that your stock portfolio is up. I mean, it will matter in that if you were in the bank, you'd be even in worse shape. But people aren't going to be richer because of rising stock prices. Meanwhile, there's a lot of Americans that don't own any stocks. So they're just going to get clobbered by all the QE because, you know, all they own is the dollars they get paid in their paycheck or what they get from the government. And those dollars are going to buy less and less.
So it sounds as though you're looking for tangible goods start to play catch up with the equities markets when things start to go parabolic. Do you see something like that, or is that an oversimplification?
I don't know that we're going to get some kind of a, you know, parabolic, you know, move up in the stock market yet. I mean, we could, but I don't think so. I think that it's going to be rocky. I think we're going to have a correction. I think the market is going to trend higher, but it's not going to just be a one-way ticket up. I think you're going to have corrections as people are fearful of the Fed tapering, and then they don't do it. There's still going to be bad earnings numbers. There's a lot of companies, particularly those that cater to, you know, people that are having bad numbers. I think you're going to start to see the home numbers, you know, weakening. So people are going to start to be worried. So there will be some corrections in the market. But the Fed is always going to be there. The Fed is going to be providing the safety net. The Fed has got the Bernanke put in place. And so that's going to keep a floor beneath the market and keep driving it higher. Because really, again, where are people going to go on Wall Street? They're not going to buy bonds because their yield is not there, and everybody knows that bond prices have to go down eventually. So everybody's got to be in the stock market. That's the only place to be. They don't want anything to do with precious metals, right? So where are they going to go? Stocks, now they're buying a little real estate. But I think the speculators that were buying real estate are slowing down considerably. The hedge fund money, they're kind of looking to exit now. A lot of those guys are trying to securitize, or they're looking to securitize their real estate portfolios and sell them on Wall Street to take advantage of the appetite for stocks, to turn their real estate into stock. So that's the only game that they can play, and they're going to keep playing it.
I wanted to discuss an interesting article I came across last week. Haven't heard anything again in the mainline media about this. Maybe you read this as well. Apparently, the FOMC and the Fed governors there have agreed to stop voting on their debt purchases at each meeting, but only once per year. And they're also combining some monetary stimulus measures, making them essentially compulsory. This seems highly inflationary, and it really makes one wonder, I think, whether or not the Fed has any type of exit plan from this money printing binge.
I mean, I've been saying that since day one, since the very first time the Fed talked about an exit strategy. I was publicly saying that they were lying, that they had no exit strategy, or I said they had checked into a monetary roach motel. I believe I'm right on that. I believe that it's all a bluff, that in the economy that lives by QE dies by QE, and therefore they can't stop. You know, it's not a genuine economic recovery that is sustainable. They have created a phony recovery that needs ever-increasing doses of QE to continue. And so if they want to contain, you know, if they want to stop it from imploding, they're going to need more QE. But they can't admit that. They can't let anybody know that that is the predicament that we're in.
I think Dr. Bernanke did his best several times over the past couple of years to talk to legislators on Capitol Hill, you know, and dropped hint after hint that we need some fiscal measures. The Fed can't carry this can down the road.
The problem there, though, is that there will be no fiscal measures as long as the Fed is giving the government a way out. So if the Fed is going to complain, well, you know, you guys need to, you know, do something. You need to, you know, reduce government spending, balance the budget, cut, you know, do something like that to remove the burden from the economy. Why should they do that if the Fed is going to monetize the debt? Because why should they make a difficult political decision if they don't have to? So what the Fed really should do is stop enabling. You know, they should just say, look, we're not going to do any more of this. So you're forced to do something because the Fed's not going to be here. We're not going to buy the bonds. We're not going to, enable these deficits. So you have no choice now. Deal with it. If you run these big deficits, interest rates are going to skyrocket, so you better do something. You know, but to continue to enable the Fed and then complain, it's like, you know, you're a drug dealer and you keep giving somebody drugs, you're giving this guy drugs, then you complain that they, you know, that they're drug addicts. And say, hey, why don't you quit the habit? Well, stop giving me drugs, you know. Then maybe they'll have to.
I wonder if you could tell folks more about an interesting video that you and your folks are working on this afternoon.
What people should do if they want to see my videos is, you know, go to my YouTube channel and subscribe. And then as soon as I've got my new videos out, you get a message. It's the Schiff Report on my YouTube channel. We've got almost 95,000 subscribers right now. We should have a lot more because I put out a lot of really good videos. So if you go to that YouTube channel and sign up, you know, hopefully this video will be out on Black Friday. And so it should be a good one if it goes according to plan. You never know what's going to happen when you go down there and try to shoot something live. And it's a collector's edition of the book, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes. I've added a couple of chapters. I have updated it for some of the things that have happened since the last, because it really explains economics in a very entertaining way. You can read the book in 3 hours. It's quite funny. So it's a good introductory course to, you know, Austrian economics. Or first book, well, it's a great opportunity to read it and start off with a collector's edition.
Well, Peter, we want to thank you, especially at this early hour, 7 a.m. Eastern Time. We typically do our interviews in afternoons and evenings. I know that this is early, and I know you have a busy schedule.
Hey, thanks.
It's a pleasure to have Harry S. Dent Jr. back on the show, the editor of the free newsletter, Survive and Prosper. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Oh, nice to be back, Chris.
You know, I'd like to begin the discussion today, if we could, with the latest FOMC meeting statement. Officials have agreed to stop voting on debt purchases, but once per year, while other monetary stimulus measures are now considered mandatory. Although the mainstream media hasn't had much to say about this event, do you agree that, you know, this QE appears to be closer to QE to infinity? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it really was funny. They did have a chance back, I think, in September, was to taper and just take a little step. I think that would have been the prudent thing to do and then see what happens. But they decided, oh, the economy's just not quite strong enough. Look, I tell you, from my view, understanding demographics and the aging of the baby boom and the debt levels in our country and other countries, things are not going to get better long term. And so the truth is they are going to have to do this forever. And in my view, it's really simple. They're going to keep stimulating until something goes wrong, like the subprime crisis in 2008. And then they're going to lose control of the system because all they've done is promote more speculation, more stock buybacks, you know, more debt, especially at the government level. They haven't dealt with the debt crisis, so it's going to come back. And so I think this is the most foolish thing I've ever seen in history, but that's what they're doing. And that's, I don't think they are going to taper. I think the economy's going to weaken next year. And by the time Yellen comes in and they'll think about tapering, they probably won't taper.
You talk about further debt, and by now listeners are aware that we're looking at about $4 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet. That number expected to increase by many of the folks who've been on the show here, maybe as much as $100 billion per month or more next year. Do you have any guidance, any ideas on what we should be looking for from the Fed? I mean, you've already alluded to the fact that you don't see any tapering. At some point where they have to recognize the fact that there's going to be an inflationary bill to pay here.
Well, you know, I thought years ago, I of course, we knew they would stimulate when we went in the 2008 downturn. Of course they would. But to 5 years to have unprecedented levels of stimulus, you'd think there'd be a limit. But the problem is the government and the financial institutions and the banks, they are so deep in this. If this bubble bursts, they are going to be in big trouble, just like in the 1930s. And so their policy is, we're just going to keep the bubble going at all costs. Now, it's absurd to think anybody could keep the greatest bubble in history going forever. But that is their policy. You're not going to get back to normal. Japan's been doing this now for two decades, and they've just gone into a coma economy. Yeah, they're not a depression or a hyperinflation, but they're not growing either. And they just had to triple their stimulus.
You know, you've been outspoken as far as an equities bear is concerned. Could you outline why you think the demographics are leading you to expect the market to reverse course and ultimately drop sharply? One of your targets I've seen as low as 3,300. I know that's an outlier.
Well, the simplest thing is the baby boom generation. We had the greatest boom in history, greater than the 40s, 50s, and 60s, or any boom in history, because the largest generation was growing up, raising kids, earning money, advancing their careers, buying houses, borrowing, all this stuff. Well, they're done. We predicted 20 years ago that the peak of the baby boomers would hit their peak in spending and start to slow down after 2007, and that's when it happened. A 46-year lag for the peak in spending of the average household on the birth index would have given you a boom from 1983 to 2007. So that boom is over. This slowdown, especially now that we got unprecedented levels of debt, we have twice as much debt for households and twice as much in total, government, private, everything, compared to GDP as we had in the 1929 bubble that burst and went into the Great Depression. When bubbles burst, debt bubbles burst, financial assets crash, debt gets deleveraged, that destroys a lot of money and creates deflation, you know, and then the governments try to stimulate too much out of that, then you get inflation on the other side. So this is, it's better to let this crisis happen, give some support to the banks, but they're not letting banks write down loans. They're giving banks free money so they don't have to write the loan. If they wrote down the $42 trillion in private debt down about half to pre-bubble levels just before 2000, but we'd be saving $1.5 trillion a year in principal interest for consumers and businesses. So To me, the government is just keeping the bubble going. Demographics only get worse, especially after 2014, and more countries see the baby boom peak. Japan was first in the 90s, U.S. next in 2007. Europe's going to hit this downturn in demographic trends starting in 2014. It's right around the corner. And then South Korea. I mean, country after country is going to go off what we call this demographic cliff. And I got a new book coming out in January, and that's the topic, that governments are fighting something that's only going to get worse, which means they would have to, Chris, stimulate up to 10 to 15 trillion on the balance sheet. They'd have to see the government debt go up to 30 trillion in the next 6 to 10 years if they're just going to keep stimulating. And obviously that would be extremely dangerous. So they're playing a losing game. They keep upping the ante, hoping we'll turn around. And I think this is going to blow up in their faces. I think it's going to blow up first half of next year is my gauge.
Well, you certainly have company. I mean, Lawrence Kotlikoff at Boston University also agrees, and somewhere in the neighborhood of $220 trillion unfunded liabilities, you add those in there. And this, of course, unsustainable debt levels. If these are just absolutely enormous figures. I mean, they're still holding rates low, buying up debt. Isn't the Fed really forcing investors, though, into equities? There doesn't seem to be a lot of alternatives.
Exactly. They're punishing savers and investors and forcing them into risky investments, which are only going to, the bubble's only going to burst. I think this bubble is going to peak by the first quarter, somewhere around 17,000 or a little bit less on the Dow, somewhere around 1,900 on the S&P, 4,200 on the NASDAQ. And I think you're going to see that the trend has been, since the late 90s, that each bubble goes to higher highs and each crash goes to lower lows. So this bubble is due to go to a little bit higher here and then due to crash probably just in the next 2 to 3 years, just like we've seen the two crashes before on this what I call megaphone pattern of higher highs and lower lows. It's due to crash down to about 5,500, give or take. That's going to be a 65% drop. So all these people they pushed into stocks and equities and risky investments are going to get crucified even more than they did last time. So this is incredibly irresponsible. But the government's doing this by doing this, lowering rates, stimulating the economy, make it easier to invest and speculate. They're saving the banks. They're saving the banks and doing on the backs of everyday consumers. So this is not going to look good in history.
No, it certainly isn't. And I wanted to ask you about a comment from Mohammed El Arian at PIMCO. He noted that the Fed is flying solo without the typical support we see, fiscal support from the government. It seems to be making an exit plan very difficult for the Federal Reserve. Typically, they'll either have some type of tax policies or government stimulus from legislators on Capitol Hill. Do you have any comments on the significance of the central banks essentially having to carry the entire burden of this Great Recession or the remnants of the Great Recession?
Yeah. The two parties are so polarized, they can't agree on anything. So we're running fiscal deficits, and that's a stimulus. We've got $7 trillion in debt since Obama came in and this crisis started. The consequence of this, since the central bank, all they can do is lower interest rates and increase speculation and drive up the markets to create a wealth effect. So again, they're creating bubbles, creating greater inequality in incomes in the country. They're creating something that's going to have to burst. If you did fiscal stimulus and were building dams and roads or something else like that, it wouldn't be pushing up financial assets. So they are creating, as you said earlier, they're creating a financial bubble, and bubbles only burst. And they don't have to burst because the economy goes down. They burst just like the real estate bubble in late 2005, early 2006, and we called that right on the nose. It burst because prices got too high and demographics of buying houses were starting to decline. It burst for natural reason. It didn't burst because the economy went into recession. The housing decline helped send the economy into recession. So people should be very worried. Look at these stock charts and look at what I said, higher highs, lower lows. Draw a line to the top of the Dow since 2000. Draw a line to the lows. That is the pattern that everybody should be looking at. And it's pretty crystal clear. We got another crash coming, and probably sooner than later.
It tends to be, according to Edwards and McGee, unstable pattern that tends to implode. And if you're right, one of those broadening patterns can lead to devastating results. And we certainly see signs of that in the Dow and the S&P 500. So it'll certainly blindside many folks. You know, the soon-to-be appointed Fed chairwoman, Janet Yellen, noted recently that the U.S. economy and the job market are performing far short of their potential And of course, this requires even more stimulus. It also seems to indicate that they're not happy with unemployment. Although we're officially seeing some improvement in the employment levels, there have been many folks on this show who claim that the unemployment numbers are bogus. I'd like to know what numbers you're looking at.
Well, first of all, we look at the unemployment rate if you adjust for the people who have voluntarily dropped out. Either they've given up finding a decent job, or they're aging baby boomers who haven't retired yet, but like two worker couples, once their kids get out of college or school, they'll say, hey, well, maybe the wife doesn't have to work anymore, or the second earner. So, but if you adjust for that, our unemployment's close to 12%. And if you adjust for people who are being forced to take part-time work instead of full-time work, it's like 16%. When it just adjusted for the decline in workforce participation, that number has basically been flat. It between 11 and 12%. It has not declined like the official unemployment numbers.
But even if we do go by competing numbers there that the Fed's looking at, I mean, we're still well above their target levels, 6.5%. And even from a historical perspective, that number is certainly nothing to be proud of. I mean, generally speaking, and because it's been so long since we've been back at more normalized figures, traditionally you would see the unemployment number fall well below, I think it was 5%, following the trough of most recessions.
Yeah, no question. I tell you, I mean, people say the stimulus hasn't had an effect. It's had a huge effect. We were going into a depression scenario, we had major banks, major companies, AIG included, General Motors melting down. This was looking just like the early 1930s. So all they did was stave off deflation and stave off a depression. The truth is, if they'd have kind of let that happen, maybe with some support to make it ease a bit, but let that happen, we would have been over this crisis by now. Between 1930 and 32, we deleveraged massive amounts of debt. Stocks crashed, real estate crashed, unemployment went up. But that forced a rebalancing of the economy, and we came screaming out of that. The growth was very fast. The stock market went up 3.5 times between late 32 and late 37. So to me, they just don't want to take pain. Look, I say, if you don't want a hangover, don't drink a bottle of bourbon. We drank the bottle of bourbon. I can't even compare past debt bubbles to this one. This one's so much larger, and it's so much more global. And it went in the shadow banking system. And we've never had, like you said earlier, we got about 400% debt to GDP in most countries, developed countries. And when you count entitlements, it's 800% to 10 times GDP. It's just off the chart, these unfunded entitlements. We've never had that before. So you've got to rebalance this thing. There's no way we can pay these entitlements with aging populations and fewer young people. And especially births are dropping in a downturn, as we predicted a long time ago. Immigration's dropping. That's going to make our demographics even worse in the forecast in a straight line in the future. So anything somebody says about future entitlements or future economic growth is going to be less than that, because births and immigration are dropping, and they're going to drop for the whole next decade, just like they did in the 1930s. So we need a reset, and we need to get down to earth. Thomas Friedman said, if we don't have a difficult decade after being on steroids for 3 decades, we're going to have a challenging century. And that's what Japan has proven. They should have come out of their downturn demographically in 2003, and they just started to a little bit and flopped back over. They're in a coma economy because they never deleveraged their debt.
Clearly was the housing asset bubble that helped pull us out of the recession of the early 2000s. We saw how poorly that ended in 2008, 2009. We're starting to see, I think, signs of bubbles everywhere. If you had to predict, if you had to make a guess, what asset bubble, other than the obvious one, equities here, is occurring now? What's going to be the next asset bubble?
Well, number one, commodities have already been declining for a number of years, and gold was the last to hold up because of all the money printing, and it's declining. And I think gold's going to bounce maybe in the next several months when this crisis starts. But I think deflation will bring down commodities in gold. I think the next big bubble in the world to burst is the Chinese real estate bubble. It's the biggest bubble in history. It's been totally government pushed beyond anything in history. And when that bursts, it's going to be like an elephant falling over. So, I mean, but you're right. There's bubbles everywhere. Real estate burst. Real estate's going to burst again. We're climbing back up. We're going to burst again. Real estate's going to burst in more places where it hasn't, like London and New York and Vancouver and Sydney, Australia, and, you know, in Korea and China and stuff, and stocks. I mean, everything before this is over, all these bubbles are going to burst. That's what happens in what we call the winter season after a bubble boom in what we call the fall season, with technologies roaring and interest rates coming down, inflation coming down, and strong demographics. You always get a bubble, but the government made this bubble bigger by pushing interest rates so low. And China made it bigger by bringing 200 million people suddenly out of rural areas and in the workforce and pushing down wages and creating a glut of savings. Chinese save a ton of money. So all of this helped fuel this big bubble. But once you get a bubble, if the bubble does not deleverage financial assets and debt, then you never really can grow again because you got too big a burden. High real estate costs make it expensive for business to compete. It makes it expensive for people to live. It's not good to have high real estate costs. And all these stuff, high stock prices mean a younger echo boomer today investing for the future can't expect much gains because they're already overvalued twice what they should be. On and on and on. The bond bubble is bursting. That's the least of them. But all these bubbles are going to burst.
It's reminiscent of 2008 and 2009, the credit crisis. So where is the safe haven under that scenario?
I think next year is going to see the next crash start, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to affect commodities, real estate, stocks, everything. Stocks will be the first to start going. There's three things you can do, and this is going back to 2008 and early 2009. What did well in that crash? And the answer is almost nothing. But you know what did well? The U.S. dollar. The dollar versus other major currencies appreciated 27%. UUP is an ETF that plays that because when we created more debt since we're the largest country, and when debt deleverages, you destroy dollars and it temporarily makes them more valuable. The other thing, the safest thing, just be in cash and save short-term bonds and CDs and T-bills and let the crash happen, and then you get to buy stuff at 40, 50, 60, 70% off. So the safest route is to be in cash, let the crash play out. We're bubbly now. I tell people for the next decade, you got to look at the markets like a long-term trader. When it bubbles up, you sell more, and when it crashes, you buy more. Because you can't be out of this market. The S&P is up 175% since early 2009, but it has bubbled up, and we're got at the top of this range. The third thing you can do, if you're really aggressive, you short commodities. You short, real estate or investment, especially stocks. I mean, I tell people, if you're going to hedge your portfolio with some percentage short stocks, because there's a big argument about inflation versus deflation, which comes when, which comes first. Stocks go down whether there's an inflationary crisis like the 70s or a deflationary. Gold and commodities like inflation, real estate like inflation, emerging countries like inflation, but in deflation, everything goes down. But the safest thing that goes down in either scenario is maybe have 20% of your portfolio short. I would recommend small cap stocks because they go down the fastest. TZA is three times short. You could just put 5 or 10% of that in your portfolio and have a good hedge.
You're essentially suggesting a bear fund for most people who aren't terribly comfortable or knowledgeable in the area of shorting stocks. I mean, it would simplify the process.
A lot of bear funds. There's an ETF called HDGE, like hedge. That's a good one. Now, my thing is we don't see any indicators that say the stock market's quite topped yet. We do expect one more rally, and the closer we get to 17,000 on the Dow, I'd say, okay, time gradually, but I would say, look, I do not see a sign that this market's getting parabolic, and it looks like it's got about another 5% to go. They've shown, though, they're cautious, but I'm going to watch the numbers in early December. I think the employment numbers are probably going to be stronger because the unemployment claims, have been very low. So if they get strong numbers, there may be talk of taper, and that's enough to scare the market. But I really would be surprised if they even get serious about tapering before March, after Yellen's end. And by then, I think by March, April, you're going to start to see signs of weakness. Where we've got a cycle that shows every time they do a big stimulus program, you get 3 to 4 quarters of improvement in GDP, and then the stimulus starts wearing off like a cup of coffee because it only works so long. And then you get 3 quarters down. So I think the especially the second and third quarter of next year are going to be weak.
And, you know, we are due, at least cyclically, for a recession. So at some point, I mean, they're going to have a difficult time, I think, keeping the ship afloat.
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing, Chris, is that if you look at bull markets, and they're defined as ending when you have a 20% or greater correction, and the average is 36%. But no bull market, except for the one from 1990 to 2000, which was had unbelievable technology trends, unbelievable demographic trends. I mean, we called that one because it was so obvious. There has no bull market has lasted more than 5 years, and this bull market's going to be 5 years old in early March of next year. That's why I say the market's going to peak between late January and probably late March.
Very good. All right. Well, ETF UUP, that's the dollar ETF that essentially tracks the U.S. dollar sans the rest of the currencies. Plus, you have the bear funds for folks who'd like to hedge their portfolios, particularly the equities in their portfolios. So it's a very interesting play and a bit defensive, but portfolio will probably thank you later on. Any other topics that you'd like to cover today as this discussion comes to a close?
No, you know, the biggest thing in the last year, I've really been zoning in on China, dug into it deeply. They are overbuilding stuff at levels that's beyond comprehension. Their stock market's been declining since February 2010 after bouncing from one of the biggest crashes in the world because they're not making any money. When you overbuild, you have too much debt, too much excess overhead and cost, and you have no profit. So China is a country growing rapidly with rapid debt, rapid vacancies in real estate, vacancies everywhere, empty malls, empty train stations, empty condos, and they're heading for, I think, potentially the biggest crash in history. So Europe may trigger this bubble burst, but I think China is going to be what causes it to get out of the control of the central banks. And I want to get out of control of the central banks. We cannot afford to have endless stimulus. We need to face the music here, get tough, restructure debt, and go on. That's what we did in the 30s, and we became the greatest nation in the world after that. We're going to become like Japan in a coma economy if we keep playing this game of we can't let the bubble burst because it's going to be too painful. It's going to be painful either way. But one way leads to resurrection, and the other way leads to endless.
No, exactly, where you just see mounds and mounds of debt piling up and future generations suffering as a result of the profligacy. I wonder if you could tell folks more about the Survive and Prosper newsletter, please.
Yeah, we have a series of newsletters, but we have a free one, a high content. It's daily. Actually, it's 6 days a week, and it's free. All you do is go to harrydent.com, put in your email.
Harry S. Dent Jr., we want to thank you for taking time for us today and wish you a happy holiday season.
Okay, thanks again, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I recently learned that my health insurance policy, which has been in effect for 2.5 years, was eliminated, and I was placed on a policy of equal benefit that was in compliance with the new ACA, or Affordable Care Act, i.e. Obamacare. I called my insurance company, and they informed me a letter had been mailed acknowledging the change and offering me the ability to opt out, which I never received. This prompted me to contact a different health insurance provider in my state and look into alternative health policies. I contacted a local insurance agent I have known for some time. After we decided on a specific company, I received a summary of 11 insurance plans being offered effective January 1st. Here's a quick back-of-the-napkin assessment of what I learned. All plans starting in 2014 will cover maternity. Up until now, certain individual plans could exclude maternity, which kept their pricing lower and more competitive. On the flip side, there will be no more expensive HIPAA plans that people go on when they have exhausted their COBRA plans, assuming they could afford their COBRA plans in the first place. This will effectively lower what were extremely high-cost HIPAA plans that people maintained when they had pre-existing conditions and were uninsurable and therefore unable to obtain normal individual policies. There will be no more lengthy medical questionnaires or underwriting for health insurance. Everyone is eligible. Pre-existing conditions are a thing of the past. These and other factors will effectively raise all the lower rates and lower the high-end HIPAA rates. My insurance agent told me that overall, those under 40 are going to see higher premiums, and those over 40 are likely to see lower premiums. Premiums are just one part of this equation. The out-of-pocket maximums for individuals and families can be a real killer. Having had family members with healthcare issues the past several years, I know what a strain any out-of-pocket payments can be. But some of the amounts in the new plans are staggering. Annual out-of-pocket maximums for an individual ranged from $2,000 to $6,250, or for families from $4,000 to $12,500, assuming you use plan providers. These are in addition to the monthly premium costs. If you go outside your plan provider, annual out-of-pocket maximums for an individual ranged from $4,000 to $12,500, or for families from $8,000 to $25,000. Again, these are in addition to the monthly premium costs, which vary based on your age. The penalty for not having health insurance in 2014 ranges from $95 to $285 per family. In 2015, it ranges from $325 to $975 per family. In 2016, it ranges from $695 to $2,085 per family. After that, it's tied to inflation. And if we move into extremely high inflation levels, as many listeners to this broadcast believe we will, the penalties in 2017 could be off the charts, as the monthly premiums are likely to be. No one has any idea how much or how little the healthcare system will be utilized under this new regime. I was told rates will either get adjusted up or down when things get recalculated for 2015. Come on, get real. Rates are always adjusted up. The question is, how high will up be next year and the year after? When the government got involved in healthcare in the 1960s, right around the time I was born, it took 30 years until Hillary Clinton tried to implement full-on national healthcare in 1994. That failed. Well, 20 years later, in 2014, national healthcare has arrived on our doorstep, ready to be enforced at the point of a gun. A financial gun, that is, in terms of escalating penalties. For those of you who are Star Trek fans, the Borg have arrived. Assimilation has begun. And we're being told that resistance is futile. Chris, on February 21st and 2nd, I'll be speaking at the 2nd Annual Liberty Mastermind Symposium in Las Vegas with 15 speakers, 3 panel discussions on one amazing day. Details are on my website, and until next time, This is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.